The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting the Yes And is Shannon Watts. Shannon is the founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, a leading force for gun violence prevention that has successfully affected change at the local, state, and national levels. Watts is an active board member of Emerge America and Rise to Run, two of the nation's leading organizations for recruiting and training women to run for office. She is the mother of five, and she has a book. It's called Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. Shannon Watts, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I was really moved by the story you tell in the introduction of your book. You talk about your son, Sam, who had experienced severe anxiety in the aftermath of the movie theater shooting in Aurora, Colorado, and I think it was 2012. And as you braced yourself to tell him about the shooting in Sandy Hook just a few months later, his reaction surprised you.
Yeah, you know, when I told him about Aurora, when he saw it on the news, it began a series of panic attacks that lasted for months. He was sleeping in my room. He was going to a therapist. And so when I saw the news just a few months later about the Sandy Hook school tragedy, my first instinct was, how are we going to let Sam know? What are we going to do? And we didn't tell him anything until Sunday night before school, thinking he would find out from his teachers or his fellow students, and sat him down and started to tell him, and he was completely unfazed. His reaction was basically, this is what happens in America, Mom. And that to me was scarier than even his first reaction.
Right. That the sort of the numbness to it had to be, I mean, that feels like that's a sting that you're like, well, that means something's really wrong.
Right. That he's apathetic.
So why moms? Why'd you go there?
You know, I get asked that a lot. And for me, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving movement in the 80s was such a pivotal moment in my teen life. Suddenly, family members who would get in their car and drive drunk, and that was considered part of normal culture, injure someone or kill someone even, and people would say, oh, we can't punish them. They've suffered enough. And a bunch of angry moms came along and really made them social pariahs. They said, look, if this is not responsible behavior, you're making a choice. And if we don't punish you, this devastation will continue across the country. And they made a huge amount of progress really by taking on a very powerful special interest as angry moms. And so the day after the Sandy Hook school tragedy, after I had watched pundits and politicians on TV saying the solution was more guns, I decided to join whatever already existed that was like MAD. But I couldn't find anything. And I just knew intuitively that really, you know, badass women are what gets things done in this country. And so I started a Facebook page, and very quickly what I thought was going to be an online conversation became an offline movement.
You have a great quote in the book. You say, quote, so it's not that we can be effective activists despite being mothers. We wield power and have access to unfathomable strength because we are mothers. I have a wife who's a mother. I had a mother. I know exactly what you mean. I mean, this is you as a mother, you do so much above and beyond.
Yeah. If you want something done, you ask a busy mom. And also, there's this caretaking responsibility that you take on when you have a child. And really, there's no way anything can stand between you and the safety of your kids. And so that was the emotion that I went on. You know, the gun lobby has made gun extremists afraid their guns will be taken away. But mothers in this country, regardless of political party, are afraid their children will be taken away.
Right. And because mothers don't just, once you have a child, you don't just care for your child, you care for all children. I mean, that's been my experience.
That's exactly right. And this is very much a community, strangers, women, mostly women, we're now mothers and others, but coming together across the country to really go toe-to-toe with the gun lobby and say, not in my community, you won't. Not in my state. You will not endanger our families and communities.
So this book surprised me. It was not the book I was expecting to read, and I say that in good ways. One of the things that is very important to our work in improvisation is recognizing that when people are improvising, they can't do it out of fear. You will not be successful if you live in fear. And you talk a lot about fear in this book. And I love this quote. You say, quote, "Once you get over the initial fear of being seen, it will get much easier to start opening your mouth." And I think that's crucial, this idea of allowing yourself to be seen. Talk about that.
Well, women in this country are, especially middle-aged women, are often invisible. We're not the gatekeepers. I say this as a white woman, so obviously for women of color, it's an even more severe situation. But this idea that once you hit middle age, that you don't necessarily hold value. And yet, for many of us, this is when we feel like we're hitting our prime and we feel the most empowered. But taking that first step to say how you feel about something that may be considered a volatile issue, or going up against someone who has been very outspoken, that takes courage. But once you do it the first time, it gets easier and easier. You know, I was terrified of public speaking when I started Moms Demand Action. I can remember calling in sick even on work days to avoid having to make any kind of public remarks. If you had told me Moms Demand Action would require me to make speeches to thousands of people, I would not have started it. but now it isn't, my brain doesn't even say to me, like, you have to be on high alert, be scared. It isn't an issue anymore because I've done it so many times. And I just think things in life are that way.
Yeah, and you also talk about, I think in this section, a little bit about mistakes, and we have a phrase in improvisation, you have to make mistakes work for you. And you say in the book, quote, "Mistakes are what you make of them." That's really speaking to a mindset that you enter with, because you understand the mistake is inevitable. And if you know that, you have a path by which you can get by it and use it.
Yeah, I think that same fear of even putting your toe in the water also makes you petrified that you are going to somehow make a mistake and be judged. And it's sometimes, I think, worth it to women to not get involved at all until all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted. And by then you've missed the moment. You know, if I had waited till I knew everything there was to know about gun violence and organizing in this country before I started Moms Demand Action, I never would have started it. So we have to be willing to fail and believe that failure is feedback.
The timing of our conversation is interesting in that I've recorded a bunch of podcasts, most of which haven't aired yet. I had one with Alicia Menendez, the journalist, she has a great book called The Likeability Trap, about how this whole likability issue with women. And we referred to this earlier in terms of how people might stereotype or think about mothers. But you worked in corporate America, which is very sexist. And I think it's important because I think it also informs the way you approached this fight, because it's not a fair fight. I think you quote in here that in the business world, women make up only 1% of Fortune 1000 CEOs. So that is a pretty lopsided figure.
And we hold only 17% of the 500,000 elected positions in this country. So there are certain levers of power that we can pull. And that's what activism is really all about. Using those levers of power available to you. For women, it is our votes, because we're the majority of the voting electorate, but it's also our spending power. We make about 80% of the spending decisions for our families. And if you have watched the news in the last month or so, you will see that all of these grocery stores have changed their open carry policy because Moms Demand Action has asked them to do so. And they understand that we are the majority of their customers.
Yeah, one of the stories you talk about early on is that happening with Starbucks, right?
Yeah. It was the first company we went after in 2013. They had just announced they were no longer going to allow smoking 20 feet outside their stores, regardless of state law. So when I called and asked about open carry, because we had seen this happening, they said they were going to keep following state law as it pertained to guns. So we were only 6 months old at the time. We were still very small. We did not even have the economic power to do a boycott. We called it a momcott. And it was essentially using the hashtag Skip Starbucks Saturdays and making images of open carry inside Starbucks go viral, whether it was handguns or semi-automatic rifles, people showing up and ordering a latte with an AR-15. And within 3 months, Howard Schultz came out on national television and said, guns were no longer welcome in his stores, not just open carry, but guns. And that was really, for us, an important moment when we realized, oh, wow, we have a lot of power and we can replicate this at other places that care about our business.
I can't fathom. I mean, I live in Chicago. There is no open carry here. And I see these images, and it feels like another world. And everyone's always shitting on Chicago, right? Around our gun problem. And you talk about the unfairness of this book, because those guns ain't coming from Chicago, right?
That's right. It's the Groundhog's Day of tweets, which is, hey, Chicago has those gun laws you want, and it's not really a gun violence free utopia, but. That's because Indiana is just a 20-minute drive over the border, and all you have to do is go to Indiana, where they have incredibly lax gun laws, load up a truck with guns bought at a gun show, and take them right back over to the Illinois side and sell them to anyone you want. And that's the whole point of why we need federal laws. Each state is only as safe as the state next to them with the weakest gun laws.
Thanks, Mike Pence.
Exactly.
So the NRA, that wonderful, this was staggering to me. They spent $30 million on Donald Trump's campaign.
They did, more than any other outside donor. That money is not accounted for. We have no idea where it came from because they don't have to report that. So for all we know, it came from countries like Russia. And it was a huge increase in any spend from any previous election, which is in itself suspicious.
But isn't the irony of that like gun sales are just disastrously low now because Trump is in office?
Yeah, we call it the Trump slump. Gun accessories and gun sales are down about $100 million because there's no boogeyman in the White House that makes gun owners afraid every time there's a mass shooting tragedy. But at the same time, you know, the NRA is just lying in wait to have a Democrat that they can use to juice gun sales again.
Yeah, especially if it ends up being a woman, right?
Exactly.
You have a great line in the book. You go, quote, the NRA plants seeds that women are not to be believed, which has other cultural implications, I think, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when you look at the NRA and they oppose us, I mean, I can't think of a single law that they have supported in the almost 7 years I've been doing this. But they also oppose domestic gun violence laws, laws that would allow law enforcement to remove the guns a domestic abuser already owns, as opposed to just prohibiting them from purchasing more. And one of the reasons that they give every time is that sometimes women lie about abuse, and you would be taking guns away from a law-abiding gun owner. And that's the misogyny and the sexism that they have used to market guns for so long.
Yeah, there's a number of stories you tell inside the book, and one of them that just sort of, again, with this open carry idea. Tell us about this meeting in Northern Kentucky for the Moms Demand Action, and this was at the Covington Local Library, I think, in 2016.
Yeah, the you can open carry in buildings in Kentucky, which is kind of crazy. And so they were having a meeting at a public library there, and they looked up, and suddenly, you know, over a dozen people open carrying walked into the library, and they were there to intimidate and silence our volunteers. And instead of being silenced or intimidated, these volunteers made them sit and listen to the entire speech and the event. And then at the end, they took pictures with them and put Moms Demand Action pins on them. And you know, that is really the conversation that happens so often. There's far more common ground, but again, the misinformation and the rhetoric that is put out by the gun lobby makes everyone feel, or at least gun extremists feel, that this is a slippery slope and that any law is going to lead to confiscation.
So, and there's so many interesting things here, but one of the things, and you talk about this in the book, in the sort of big tent section, which is, you know, there's such lines drawn in this country between right and wrong, good and bad, you know, evil. It's crazy. We're so divided. And I get the sense in the book that, you know, you're really striving to not let those divisions stop us from reaching across the aisle, from trying to engage these people. Because if you look at all the data and research around this, you know, when people are, you know, like a gay couple moves next door to someone, the data overwhelmingly sees that homophobia drifts away. I get the sense from you that you know, you're not looking at canceling out a bunch of people. You're looking at trying to just reach other people for a greater sense of understanding.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at the data, 90% of Americans support stronger gun laws, 80% of gun owners, only 1 in 10 of whom belong to the NRA, 74% of NRA members. This is really about an extreme leadership of the gun lobby. It's about a special interest that has too much money and power. And we don't have to convince that vocal minority of gun extremists to vote with us. We really just have to get this, what has been the silent majority for too long, to use their voices and their votes on this issue. And if we do that, if we explain to them that this is moderate, research, data-driven solution, then we will change the structure. But until that happens, and that takes several election cycles, you know, to educate people and to get them to vote specifically on this issue. We're seeing it more and more. But when that happens, I think that's when the dam breaks.
Another surprise in the book was the way you talk about privilege and your privilege. And I think I'm on this journey, too, as a 53-year-old white man who is reading more and more and realizing the effects of systemic racism and inequality as it goes to housing and so many different things. And you write in the book, and you're talking about how you've never been directly affected by gun violence. And you say, quote, "I want to acknowledge the privilege of that last point. How lucky I was that gun violence had not hit closer to home for me than Sandy Hook. Many people of color don't have that luxury." So talk about how this aspect of your journey where your eyes were maybe open, because you went in thinking about these mass killings when, in fact, the majority of killings by guns happen, you know, by handgun.
That's right. And I was a white suburban mom living in a bubble. I didn't know anything about gun violence. But after Sandy Hook, I felt like my kids weren't safe in their schools. And so many other women who lived like me and looked like me got involved, too. They decided that was what was going to get them off the sidelines. But the reality is that mothers and women, particularly women of color, have been on the front line of this issue in their communities for years, for decades. And physically putting their bodies on street corners to prevent gun violence where they live. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have definitely been on a journey to make sure that our organization isn't focused just on the mass shootings and school shootings, but the everyday gun violence that kills 100 Americans, whether it's city gun homicides or rural gun suicides or unintentional shootings by children, all of it matters and all of it has to be solved.
I think it's your colleague, Lucy McBath, who said, you quote her as saying, "Always seek to listen first." And I think that's so important for people like you and I, is that sort of humble listening that you want to do, to recognize that someone else's experience is probably far more dangerous than your experience, and how they put themselves out is a far more dangerous experience for them. And you can learn from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And not only do you need to listen, but you need to lift them up. And I was at a meeting last night in Boston, and a Moms Made Action volunteer stood up, a woman of color, and the audience was mostly white. And, you know, she was talking about the need for volunteers to not just show up at our events, but to show up at the events in their communities, particularly those by Black Lives Matters and other mothers and women working on this issue. And that's so incredibly important. You know, this has to be a partnership.
You also talk about the keys to sort of building this movement and what you learned being a leader. And one of the we have a concept in improvisation that applies to leadership, which is called follow the follower, that you have to realize as a leader that sometimes you need to follow your people and vice versa. And it's never sort of static. And you say in the book, quote, "In order to be a successful leader, you've got to ensure that the workload is shared." And that's a theme where you had to do some letting go, which was maybe not the thing you're best at.
No, I mean, I am a type A woman, full stop. And there are often times when I feel either that I can do it best or that giving that work to other people is being burdensome and I'm not doing my duty. And I think those things are specific often to women who take on so much in their lives. And I talk a lot about how gun violence prevention is a marathon, not a sprint, but it's also a relay race. And we have to be able to hand the baton over to other people when priorities in our life take precedence. You know, my daughter has an eating disorder, and there have been many times in the last almost 7 years where I've had to step back. And never once has the organization stumbled or performed poorly. The world doesn't end just because I need to focus on myself or my family. And that's a really important lesson that I think we need to learn so that we don't burn out, but also that we give everyone a chance to do their part.
Yeah, because it's also not natural, right? We grew up with these images of what a leader means to be that were never true, you know, that they're the making all decisions and they're doing all this and they're in charge of the details and the vision. Again, that's not the way it works in any business that I've been a part of. The other thing you talk about, and this is regarding sort of persuasion, you have a phrase where you call well-timed vulnerability can be very persuasive. Talk about that, because that, again, that might be a little bit opposite the person you are, but it really is important in attempting to change people's minds.
Yeah, it is. It is about listening. It is about understanding other people's experience, sharing your own. I think Twitter and other social media outlets have often made us experts at clapbacks. I know that.
I don't know what you're talking about.
That yeah. I have created a skill set in, but there is. It is important to not be cynical and not be hopeless, and to be open and have those conversations. And you may be disappointed, but. You know, what if you're not? And that's how you advance the ball so often.
So I tweeted this out, speaking of that, the other day. It's a quote from your book, but you're quoting Glennon Doyle when she says, if you aren't kind on the internet, then you're not kind.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of responses to that. People really liked it. A lot of people were retweeting.
Oh, interesting. You know, it is so true. And I can't tell you how many times I've written a tweet and then scrapped it or posted it and then deleted it because it got too snarky or it wasn't kind. And I think it's important that we realize that sometimes that's a lesson in progress, but also to be watching for it. It mm-hmm. is so easy to not see people on the other end of the computer and to try to be funny or score points or whatever it is. And it isn't just bad for other people, it's bad for you, and it doesn't make you feel good. And look, if you can't be an activist or advocate for a cause without engaging in ad hominem attacks, then you probably don't have a very firm foundation to stand on.
Yep. You were talking about your reach online being about 4 million people, and you compared that to, that's like Colbert's average audience, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if our mutual friend Tracy told you about this, but he was over at our house on Sunday and we were hanging out in the garden. I'm like, oh, I'm interviewing Shannon Watts, who mentions you in the book. And he's like, who?
Oh, wow.
And so I actually gave him your name and he wrote it down. So hopefully, I don't know,
gosh.
You know, stranger things have happened, but it was just such a, you know, weird confluence of like,
yeah.
You know, how are these different things. But we were and talking about that sort of online space where our behavior is completely different. But you actually say, and I don't know if I agree with you, but I'll say, you say, I definitely believe that the benefits social media offer far outweigh the potential harm. And let me ask you this. Do you still believe that since you wrote that?
I do, but I'm also speaking as an activist.
Yes.
So I can shut out all of the death threats and the threats of sexual violence to me, to my girls. And I can use it as a tool to organize privately and publicly and to put pressure on companies and lawmakers and other influencers. And that, you know, I always wonder how Mothers Against Drunk Driving did it. Did they drive to each other's houses? Did they, you know, call each other
on
their ordinary phones?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how they achieved so much, but it turbocharges everything we're doing as advocates. But is there a very dark downside of the internet? Is it changing our brains and our interactions? Yes, I do believe that. And it is hard to say if the trade-off is worth it, but I would certainly say in terms of advocacy, it is.
Yeah. And so, you know, along those lines, I mean, Facebook is problematic for a number of reasons, and I'm on it. I use it. And it's been very helpful for me in terms of, you know, I had a long medical journey with my daughter, and it was a great place for people to share and contribute or help. I was blown away by the fact that you said that Facebook was one of the largest online markets for unlicensed gun sales.
Yes, and let me say I'm so sorry about all your family has been through.
Oh,
and
thank you.
Thinking of you and what you all are going through. But in terms of Facebook, you know, we started on Facebook.
Yeah.
That was where I went to organize. And we very quickly learned that they were one of the largest online gun marketplaces and that they were not requiring background checks on person-to-person transactions. And so when you can advertise on Facebook and say, hey, no background check required, it's an easy way for domestic abusers, felons, minors to get guns. So we started a campaign against Facebook and asked them to change their policy. And they now no longer allow those advertisements. And so that was a huge and important win, and also sent a really strong cultural signal, especially to this platform that most customers are women.
Yeah, and that didn't happen overnight. You guys, you kept pushing and pushing and pushing, right?
It took 2 years. So In the first few months, they came to us with about 9 concessions, and those were great, but they weren't enough. And so we kept pushing. And eventually, they completely undid their sales online.
So in a moment, I'm going to come to you for a yes and story, which we always ask every guest a time in their life when they normally would have said no, but instead they said yes and. I mean, this is kind of a layup for you, but God bless. Before I do that, I want to talk about a couple different things that your organization has done so people can have an idea, because there's obviously sort of advocacy in the traditional trying to get laws changed, but you did it in a unique sort of mom way. So talk to us about the lemonade stand offensive.
You know, we wanted to engage in things that would attract women and mothers, but also allow their children to be involved in activism. And a few of those stroller jams, we realized when we brought all our baby paraphernalia and kid stuff that it created this log jam in the hallways, and lawmakers couldn't get around us easily, so they would have to answer our questions. And so we started having stroller jams everywhere. We would have craft projects where moms and kids could work together on messages to their lawmakers. But then we also had lemonade stands. And it was this idea after Manchin Toomey failed in 2013, which was a bill that would have closed the background check loophole right after Sandy Hook, that we were going to turn lemons into lemonade. And so we started having lemonade stands all over the country and raising money for Moms to Be in Action. And I can remember having one at the Capitol, and you know, all these senators were coming out buying our lemonade. And it was just a very mom thing to do.
Complete. And I really hope you trademark stroller jams, because I mean that you could have
we
a
did.
Whole other line. You did great.
We did.
Oh, I love
of
it.
Course.
All right. So, a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I do. You know, I was asked to do some public speaking the very week or so that I started Moms Demand Action. And I mentioned earlier that public speaking was not my forte. It was something that actually terrified me. And I was asked to speak on, I believe it was January 26th. That can tell you how much of an issue it was for me that I remember the date. I was asked to speak to a big crowd in Washington, D.C. At a post-Sandy Hook rally for stronger gun laws. And I did not want to. And I said yes anyway. And I can remember holding my coffee, and I was shaking so much that the coffee wouldn't stay in the cup. That's how nervous I was. And it was the coldest day I've ever experienced. It was outdoors, and I was strangely seated in between Kathleen Turner and Arnie Duncan.
Okay.
And I'm just thinking, like, I am a stay-at-home mom from Indiana. What in the world am I doing here? And speaking to the crowd and wanting to flee so many different times, not just that day, but in the lead-up to that event, and feeling so proud afterward that I had overcome that, and feeling like I can do this.
I love it. The book is Fight Like a Mother, How a Grassroots Movement Took on the Gun Lobby and Why Women Will Change the World. Shannon Watts, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Getting the SAN is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey.
The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. I'm thinking this must not be where we belong. And the world split in two from the throng of every living soul, screaming at the top of their lungs, saying this is my.
Survive.